Hello out there, everybody, the legions of the unspoken. Welcome to our second audio incursion here at theunspokendecade.com. We had a great time talking Zero Hour with Dan Juergens a couple months back. And to close off Madness Month, the third month of the year, the month when, you know, all that madness happens, something about some basketball. We can't say exactly what that is due to the NCAA, but we have exposed you to all kinds of madness this month at the Unspoken Decade, and we're closing it out as the madness trickles down by inviting an interloper into the Unspoken Decade, a guy who is a good friend of mine and really helped propel the Unspoken Decade and my blog writing career, whatever that is supposed to mean, would entail, into whatever stratosphere it's in now. And I really thank him, and he does a great job at Longbox Graveyard, and of course, you know, good friend of the unspokendecade.com, Paul O'Connor. I want to welcome you into the lion's den.
Thank you, Dean. I am delighted to be here.
And I'm pouring it on thick. Now, there's not any hostility between Paul and I. And I think, you know, one of the big reasons why there can't be much hostility is because I'm just such a big fan. I binge read everything that you wrote in like a month and a half period. And then I've been honored to have actually had a little bit of work published over at your Longbox Graveyard.
This is true. You published several times at my blog, Dean. It's one of the reasons it's probably still going. Frankly, I'm in my fourth year and I've reduced my publication from, I started off at once a week and I'm down to once a month. And when I get a talented guest blogger and such as yourself, it lets me take a month off. So you are welcome to come by any time at Longbox Graveyard.
Well, and I think that the fact that I love Bronze Age comic books so much and I'm unabashed about it, I think that's might have led you to this conversation a little bit, in that anybody who respects the Bronze Age as much as I do and then has very, very nice things to say about 90s comics, I might not be entirely wrong.
Well, it does seem like those are two great tastes that maybe don't taste so great together. It's a little peculiar. But, you know, you're a wise man with far-ranging tastes. I'm not surprised that you can appreciate the inherently superior Bronze Age of comics, and I'll excuse your unfortunate infatuation with, what do we call the 90s anyways? The plastic age? Does it have an official title?
You know, at the Unspoken Decade, we say, you know, the gimmick era has never been covered so well.
I think that's perfect. That's an excellent choice. And my colleagues at Malibu Comics, who are largely responsible for letting many of those gimmicks out of the bag, I'm sure would applaud that title.
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with gimmicks, and that's a great place to start this back and forth. One of the things that the 90s gets really harped on a lot when it comes to comic books is gimmick covers and alternate covers and newsstand editions and doing things just to sell comic books. And I admit, I'm not going to, you know, there's no way that I could possibly ever, you know, deny that there were a great many marketing stunts, gimmick covers, and ploys just to sell comic books in the 90s. I'm pretty sure that gimmick covers in the 90s created entire industries in of themselves. Like, who had heard of holofoil before that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the gimmick covers certainly created an industry in themselves, but they also created a bubble that took the whole comics business down with it, which is another unfortunate black mark against the 90s, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I don't disagree, but we're jumping a little ahead, but I think that the 90s and the 70s have a lot of parallels, and if you look at the same era, if you look at the same years and the decades, or, you know, in 1997, people weren't sure that there'd be a Marvel Comics in 3 years. And in 1977, people weren't sure if there'd be a Marvel Comics or a DC Comics in 3 years. I think the big difference there, and we'll get into this a little bit more later because I want to come back to my point about the gimmicks, is that the direct market showed up to save comic books in the late 70s. But nothing really showed up in the late 90s to save comic books. There wasn't a new outlet or a new market. And I think that's one of the big differences between them. But I think there are a lot of parallels to be drawn. But when it comes to the gimmick covers and doing things just to sell books, I don't feel like that separates the 90s from any other decade in comic book history. I mean, Martin Goodman, the father of what would become Marvel Comics, he never saw a trend that he couldn't capitalize on. If you had one war book and it was hot, by God, he'd have 45 the next month. And that's not a very big exaggeration.
Oh, no, absolutely. absolutely. I agree. Comic books have always been an exploitative art. They have a lot in common with exploitation films in that regard. They find out what's fascinating to the public and quickly turn and burn on that, try to get a book in front of people while it's hot. And that's shared by all eras. I agree. I think the primary difference between the 70s and the 90s is not so much the subject matter as much as its approach. We can talk about the creative approach later and the way the companies were structured. But to me, the single biggest difference, maybe it's kind of boring for the listeners, but for me, the single biggest difference is business difference. In the 70s, the customer of a comic book was the newsstand operator as an intermediary, but ultimately it really was the readers that would show up, buy books, write in, let their feelings be known in letter columns, etc. In the 90s, it shifted from the customer being the readers to the customer being the comic shop operators. And the reason this is important is because of the way solicitations work for direct sales. The solicitations were written to attract the attention of a comic shop dealer or comic shop owner who felt then, I can go ahead and sell these comics through to the readers. And the choices that he was making were based not so much on the merits of the book as much as on things like those aforementioned gimmicks. Because there was such a flood of content, the publishers had to do anything they could to make themselves stand out. Sometimes that was superior product and better creators, etc. But more often than not, I'm afraid, developing gimmicks, crazy covers, poly bags, etc. And I know that this is something that Malibu Comics, I mentioned them earlier, I was a freelancer for Malibu in the 1990s, and I was still very close with a lot of the editorial guys over there and the key creators of the Ultraverse, etc. They've admitted to me straight up that what kept their company alive well beyond its sell-by date was that they cracked the code and realized, you know what, we're not selling to fans, we're selling to distributors, and really we're selling to, because there was only one distributor of note at the time, and really we're selling to the comic shop owners. And that ultimately led, I think, to an unhealthy market that helped propel that bubble that caused everything to collapse.
I think that's a very fair point. And I think that when we talk about the collapse of comic books, one of the things that never gets mentioned is the collapse of baseball cards. And I think a lot of people out there would be like, you know, what does that have to do with anything? What's that got to do with the price of, you know, Prime in 1995? Well, the answer is there was a huge speculative bubble in baseball cards in the late 80s. And I was a part of that bubble as a young man, you know, being in third, fourth grade, huge baseball fan to this day. Really excited to see my American League champion Kansas City Royals as soon as possible. But that's an aside. But as the people, as that bubble burst, those same people wound up going into the comic book business, and those same speculators, you know, were guys who would hype and buy hype and get customers to believe that if they just bought eight copies of Fantastic Four number 371, that, you know, they would be rich forever because it had the, you know, foil embossed white Human Torch cover that's impossible to keep mint. If you look at it for more than 4 seconds, there's a spot on it. It's just the way it is. It's probably a law of physics about it. And you combine that with the fact that QVC, all of a sudden, when the baseball card bust happened, now they start selling comic books too, and they have these guys on there, the same people who are like, you know, the same shysters who are selling you that crappy sewing machine that, you know, that my grandma bought in the middle of the night. Now they're selling you comic books, telling everybody that you're gonna be super rich if you buy them. You got Garib Sheamus of Wizard going on CNN saying the same thing, and then in the early 1990s, that was when Action Comics number one in near mint, I think it sold for six figures. I can't remember the exact number, but all of that was like a perfect confluence of events to create that bubble.
Yeah, and I think it's probably a litmus test in the future that if something shows up on QVC, it's no longer cool. I think we can agree to that.
At least worthless.
Of an impending collapse. I think it's an astute observation to link it to the card market. I think you're right. Marvel, especially in the mid to late 90s, they were a collectible company. That's the train they thought was never going to run out of steam. They owned a toy company and Toy Biz. The guy that ran Flair, Bill Jemis, moved over and started running Marvel later. And he brought a lot of those assumptions about the card market to the way he was running Marvel Comics. So they believed that they basically had a cash machine, that they could create artificial scarcity by the numbers and the distribution methodology they use for printing these comic books, and that the party would never end. And obviously, it did end. And I think one of the observations that my friend Chris Almas made a number of times, and Chris was editor-in-chief at Malibu Comics all through the existence of that company and through the buyout by Marvel at the end, is he noted that when the business shifted from selling comics through to readers and instead selling comics to speculators that were buying multiple copies of something and then putting them in boxes and never reading them, that's when they were doing a tightrope walk without a net, because it doesn't take a lot for that kind of business to collapse. If the comics you're selling are more or less on a one-to-one basis, and you're selling 100,000 copies a month of a comic, that's a pretty healthy market for you. But if you're selling 100,000 copies a month of a comic to 25,000 readers, then it's really fragile, because it doesn't take many of those guys to walk away for that bubble to burst. And unfortunately, that's what happened with comics in the 90s.
Yeah, I think in particular, that's the downfall of Valiant, is that they thought that they had a readership of something like 200, 300,000 people, and it was probably, 33% of that. And it doesn't take much, like you said, for that brick in the wall to fall out, and the whole wall will come tumbling down. And as you stated, again, I'm not here, and I think sometimes I get accused of this, like I'm a '90s apologist. Look, what happened in the '90s happened in the '90s. I'm not. There's no way to avoid these facts. I've read Comic Wars. I know what happened to Marvel.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to put a pin in it, maybe we'll start talking about the fun stuff instead of business. The guys that ended up holding the bag were the retailers. They're the people that were caught in the middle, ended up with tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars sometimes in stock that was worthless to them that they couldn't sell, and they went bankrupt. And then that ecosystem died out. when that ecosystem died out, comics entered kind of a modern dark age in terms of their ability to attract new readers and remain a vibrant form. At least we're talking superhero comics, North American superhero comics. So it's had far-ranging effects that the business has never fully recovered from. It's never gotten back to those crazy, superheated, inflated numbers of the Image era. It certainly rebounded creatively and as a vibrant art. But in terms of raw numbers and the ability for individual freelancers to make a living in the field, it's never come back to the height it enjoyed in the 1990s before the boom.
Yeah, and that's really sad. Like I said earlier, it seems like in the 70s when things started to go really badly, and DC's having meetings to say, after the DC implosion, where they basically laid off something like 80% of the company's ridiculous numbers, and there were people like, we're just going to do merchandise for now, and we're just going to do licensing, we don't have to keep doing comic books. Well, at the same time, Marvel was selling tons of comic books, but was so mismanaged that Jim Gulton, I can't remember who owned it at the time. I keep wanting to say Curtis, because that's their magazine. That's the people who made the fancy black and whites. That's what they slapped on there. But those people were just like, we can't just keep losing money like this, no matter how much it's selling. And I think that the direct market was, obviously in hindsight, it saved the day, but it also contributed to that whole bust in the 90s. And also, I think also that another ties from the 70s to the 90s, Paul, is the birth of the direct market and the death of the newsstand. Because when I first started getting comic books in the early 90s, you could still get comic books at Walmart, Kroger, assorted convenience stores. I picked up my first Malibu comics, believe it or not, on the newsstand. You could get Protectors and Ultraverse on the newsstand. And also, my town of 8,000 people could still support a comic book store. In 95, when the comic book store closed, that's about the same time the newsstands were gone. And that's an interesting cycle in about 20 years.
Yeah, well, the newsstands, of course, in California, we had the 7-Eleven stores, the legendary spinner rack at 7-Eleven. You'd ride up on your bike, you'd get a Slurpee cup with Batman on it. You'd go buy a book off the spinner rack. And there's no doubt that that was first exposure to comics for a lot of people. And there are those today who lament that that channel doesn't exist to attract new readers. That may or may not be a specious argument, I'm not sure. But I do agree. I bought my first comic book off a newsstand in 1974. One of the reasons I love the 70s, I was 12 years old in 1974, and that's when I got into comics, right? But I bought my first books off a newsstand for 25 cents or 20 cents. And I would not have And actually, uniquely, I lived in Hollywood at the time. I was actually had some comic book shops on Hollywood Boulevard, and I went in there and bought back issues, which is really cool. But my first point of entry really was those newsstands. And the newsstand system was very different because it was non-returnable. And what that means is, it was a returnable market. The direct market was non-returnable. So what that would mean, broadly stated, is a comic book owner would say, give me 6 issues of, Spawn, and I'll buy them, and then I'll sell them through. And if I can't sell them through, it's up to me to eat it or find some other way to move the stock. Of course, on the newsstands, everything was sold on a returnable basis. It was more like a product that came in with a month date on it that showed not the date the book shipped, but the date you're supposed to take it off sale. You take that book off sale, if it's sat on your rack for 3 months, you strip the cover off it, literally tear the cover off, mail the cover back to the distributor, and you get a credit on next month's product. So it ended up being a very stable business for newsstands, where they knew, you know, it was all about rack space rather than about product necessarily, which led to some really wildly varying quality in the 70s, I'll give you that. But it was an inherently stable business. But it was also a business that had these crazy bubbles in it of its own. So you were talking about the DC implosion, for instance. Because of the way returnable sales worked in the newsstand era, it would be weeks or months sometimes before a publisher would know if something was selling or not. So what happened to DC is they went on this crazy expansion program, created lots of additional titles, and then 3 months later they get back the catastrophic news that none of them are selling. The new books aren't selling, the old books aren't selling, the whole business is in retreat, and that's why suddenly they canceled, what was it, like 60 books overnight or something. In the direct market era, you'd have a better idea if your book was going to fly or die, but you also would have to do crazy things to artificially inflate the sales of your issue number one because you knew issue number two was going to drop off by 65%, and that was just the game you played. And then business changed from a business, a sort of a stable business that supported comic books that were numbered into the hundreds, like the old runs of Action Comics, for instance, you know, into the 400 or 500s, and were replaced by gimmick numbering, where comics series were recycled after every 4 or 5 issues. Frankly, everything became a limited series in the 90s, it seemed like, because the sales had dropped off so precipitously after that number one, which had artificially high sales. And that struck me as a sad thing, because there was just so much churn. The business began to reward the people that were the best promoters rather than the people that were the best creators.
Yeah, and the limited series became, you know, something that was kind of a joke in and of itself. You had guys like Venom when they decided to, you know, make him a semi-good guy. When he got his solo title, they were like, well, it's not going to be an ongoing series. It's going to be a series of limited series. What the hell does that even mean?
Yeah, well, you know, the limited series, it was interesting. When limited series began, I thought that it was a real interesting idea, the notion that a story could end. You could tell something at the beginning and middle and an end. And, of course, we had Dark Knight, we had Watchmen in the 80s, which were both spectacular limited series. And then the limited series also solved a couple problems. One is it made something feel new and fresh. You could take a flyer on a character or an idea that maybe didn't merit its own book. It kind of replaced the tryout books that they had at the time, the Marvel premieres or the Marvel spotlights or whatever. So that was cool. And it also gave the publishers an opportunity to refresh copyright on characters that hadn't appeared in print for a long time. So suddenly up would pop this obscure character you'd never heard of. Why do they have a 4-issue series? Well, they were reestablishing their right to own that particular character. So that was useful. But I think they did end up become kind of disposable. I would love for they were definitely a creation of the direct market. There's no way those things would have worked on newsstands because of the way they ordered their books. Now, I got to say, there's some books in the 70s that I would have loved to have been limited. I think it's the 70s, 80s, because it would have served the idea better. When Jack Kirby came back to Marvel Comics in the mid-70s and he did The Eternals, I love The Eternals, but that would have been a dynamite 12-issue series.
Absolutely.
It was never going to work as an open-ended series, and that ended up being its death. But if it was something that he could have plotted with a beginning, a middle, and an end, it would have been, I think, a lot better. Same is true of a lot of his New Gods work, I think. Trying to do those as open-ended continuing books was a disservice to the concept. And I think Kirby thought in terms of, he always talked about how he wanted his books, his comics to be collected into volumes and kept permanently in stock in libraries and et cetera. So he had the mind to plot a limited series and really would have benefited from it, but the business structure didn't exist in a time frame to tell stories in that way.
I think also when we see the first proliferation of limited series in the 80s, I think it was also a way to get some revenue out of an existing, you know, cash cow, if you will, without milking it dry entirely. I mean, in the early 80s, you know, you saw a lot of like X-Men related miniseries, you know, limited series like Nightcrawler, Iceman, several Wolverine limited series. It's weird to think that Wolverine didn't get an ongoing until like 88 or 89. And I honestly think, and this is pure conjecture, but that was just a way to, you know, to get a little extra revenue out of the X-Men market. And also, you know, and also see if Nightcrawler would take off if he did have that following. They knew most of them wouldn't, but here was a way to get a little extra revenue and give something to the fans of Nightcrawler or Iceman or whatever, guys that might, you know, kind of fall by the wayside in a crowded book like X-Men or New Defenders.
Oh yeah, very clearly. And the other thing is to realize that comics have always been a zero-sum game in terms of the way the businesses compete with each other. So Marvel's always looked at it. DC looks at it the same way. As every dollar a reader is spending on a Marvel book is a dollar they're not spending on a DC book, and vice versa. So in that kind of environment, and this goes all the way back to newsstands, it's no different than when you're competing for rack space. In that environment, you have every incentive to overproduce because you're trying to crowd the other guy out of the market, trying to starve him of dollars. Now, you take a step back, and it's an unhealthy ecosystem because you got too many books chasing too few dollars. But when you're sitting behind a desk and you have a hot property like X-Men, and you can flood the market with X-Men books, whether they're regulars, ongoings, miniseries, one-shots, whatever, there's very little disincentive for you to do that. And then the other thing that was going on, at least at Marvel at the time, is the way Marvel was organized is they had competing editors-in-chiefs at one point, each of which was in charge of a different line. So there was an X-Men line, there was a Spider-Man line, there was a line that had Fantastic Four and some other characters.
Right.
Those editors were all pitted against each other for their profit and loss. So not only were they competing with DC by overproducing, but they were competing internally by overproducing within their own lines so that they showed great profit at the expense of their peers. It's crazy, but that's the way the business was operated.
No, it was insane in every which way, the Marvelution process in the 1990s. That did. It split Marvel up, like you're saying. There was like Spider-Man. There were Marvel heroes. That's where you'd find like Avengers, Captain America, probably the Fantastic Four, Marvel Edge, Marvel Alterniverse. And some of these were split up unfairly. I mean, like, listen, if you're the dude in charge of the Spider-Man books, you've got four regular titles going on, right? Plus, you know, a myriad specials. On the other hand, if you're the Alterniverse guy, I hope you're making lots of money off that What If book, bro.
Yeah, no kidding. What it does is it creates inequity. The guys in any sort of boardroom meeting, the guys that are running the Spider-Man and the X-Men franchises have all the poker chips, and everybody else is just sort of, you know, looking for scraps.
Right, and it's also led to some misconceptions. One thing that I've heard people say in lots of 1990s groups is they're like, Marvel Edge was the precursor to Marvel Knights, and they think so because there are a lot of the same characters were involved, Punisher, Daredevil, Doctor Strange. I'm like, that's not true. Like, Marvel Edge, you know, it was just ran by an editor-in-chief internally. The real precursor to Marvel Knights is Heroes Reborn, when they license their characters out to creators to basically have carte blanche with them. And that's really where I think you see, you know, where we got Marvel Knights.
Yeah, absolutely. With Marvel Knights, it was a case of Marvel management losing confidence in their internal creating creator staff and saying, we need new blood, we're going to go outside and find people to do Marvel Knights for us. The difference between that and the early, you know, disastrous experiment with the Heroes Reborn was that they, with Marvel Knights, they installed those guys on the premises at Marvel. They put them on a different floor. They were considered separate from standard Marvel editorial and creative staff, and there's a lot of resentment and internecine warfare between the floors of the business at the time. But Marvel Knights was an attempt to do something new, but keep it a little closer than had been the case when they just tossed the keys to all those Image kids that had so savagely walked out of them several years before.
And paid them huge sums of money again. And there was no benefit from that, unfortunately. And I think that's what they were hoping would kind of save comic books at that time, would have been the equivalent of the 70s direct market, which would have been like, oh, we'll kind of farm these guys out. These guys have the big names. But those days were just over, and, you know, unfortunately, we'll never see them again. We'll also never see that kind of, I don't know, the creative lightning that was everywhere. I mean, I think the 70s and the 90s compare very favorably in regard to that, in that there was a wide range of books coming out from the big two. The 90s are, of course, aided and abetted by companies like Malibu with the Ultraverse, Topps getting into the Kirbyverse, Dark Horse, etc. But both Marvel, like Marvel in the early 70s and Marvel in the 90s, putting out like 70, 75 ongoing titles every month. In the 90s, you have everything from like Hellraiser and Clive Barker superheroes to Alien Legion to Akira to New Warriors. In the 70s, you're going everywhere from, you know, classic sword and sorcery to those crazy, Tomb of Dracula books, all the way back to, you know, Hanna-Barbera licensed books.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I think in the 90s, certainly the first rush of that direct market era, which started in the very late 80s, and then into the image explosion, et cetera, there was enormous diversity. Well, not diversity is the wrong word, but there was a huge variety of comics available because there was suddenly this channel that supported them. Comics could turn a profit out of very low print run, especially on the black and white side. And there were readers that had money and were interested in this art form coming into it and being willing to sample a lot of stuff. So there was all sorts of crazy stuff, some good stuff, some crap stuff, but there's also the crazy stuff that you could find. There weren't as many books on the stand in the 70s, but in its own way, it was an era of almost equivalent experimentation, but for entirely different reasons. It's because the editorial staffs at these comic book companies, especially Marvel, were so sleepy at the time that you could get away with all sorts of crazy stuff. So wild books would come out, that would sort of almost, you felt like they slipped through the censor sometimes when you read a book like Deathlock or Don McGregor's run on Black Panther.
A lot of Warlock stuff, too.
It's like coming from another planet. But they were sort of accidental masterpieces rather than the things they were trying to engineer in the lab in the 90s.
I don't think that everything was just engineered in a lab in the 90s, though. I think that a lot of those guys, even the Image guys, they get really knocked for what they did and how they did it, but I defy you to show me somebody who captured the Zeke guys through the early 90s better than Rob Liefeld.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you know what? I admire the Image guys, all of them. They had leverage and they used it. And they used it to make themselves extraordinarily wealthy. And they really were. Talk about being in the right place at the right time, those Image guys. But the disappointment I have in them is that they became what they hated. They had this opportunity to redefine the form. And what they did is they basically drew their own cooler versions of the Marvel characters that they had made their fame upon, and didn't really treat the business or the people that worked with them that much better than they themselves were treated when they were working on the farm at Marvel. And now, ironically, years later, now Image Comics, contemporary Image Comics, has become this mecca for creator-owned properties and publishing great books. And they have enormous respect for individual creators. So Image eventually evolved into the promise that it could have been when it was launched in the 90s. It just took, the better part of 2 decades to get there.
Well, they put out a lot of books early on that they didn't own, that were creator-owned, like, I know you're a Jerry Ordway fan. I mean, who isn't, right? I mean, they put out his book, Wildstar, Mike Grell's Shaman's Tears, Johnson and Stroman on Tribe. And I don't know the particulars, but at some point they just axed most of those books, sometimes with very little warning. And of course you also had like Pit by Dale Keown and the amazing and weirdly abstract The Max by Sam Keith, which of course achieved mainstream success by being on MTV.
Yeah, and the other thing is that the thing they reacted to, and I'm not an expert in Image, but this is looking at it from the outside in, is I think that they reacted to this idea that we're a bunch of artists. We have a studio, everybody kind of goes their own way. I don't think there was a lot of adult supervision necessarily at Image at the time, and as a consequence, folks were always late, or books were solicited and didn't come out, or, some of these series that abruptly would disappear. You don't always know what's rumbling behind the scenes in terms of disagreements between creators or disagreements over money or disagreements over publication schedules, promises, etc. So without a real steady hand at the tiller, that was another thing that I think ensured that Image didn't fulfill the very brilliant promise it had when they got started.
I absolutely, and there's lots of great documentation of that. They certainly they didn't know exactly what they were getting into, and you know, they cut ties with Malibu after a year. And I think there's a quote from Jim Lee that I think Dave Ulbrich, you know, uses in Image. The Road to Independence that was put out by Tomorrow's, where he's like, he said he could get trained monkeys to do what, you know, Malibu was doing for them. And Dave Ulbrich was like, I knew that, you know, it hurt him, but he's like, I knew very soon he would disagree with me. We were doing a lot for them and they didn't know it.
Well, sure. And Jim, of course, now he's the man, right?
right.
And he's running DC Comics, and Jim's a great guy. And I know that he's regretted those words, and I know that he's personally apologized to Dave for saying that. He was just a young guy, and that what flew out of his mouth. But Jim's a very sharp cat too. He's Ivy League educated. He was of the guys that broke away from that formed that original group of Image creators. Him, you know, Jim Lee and McFarlane were the guys that had a real business sense, the real vision for what life would be like beyond just drawing cool characters every month.
Yeah, and it's funny too because they both had savvy business sense, but they were coming from almost a complete opposite angle. In that Jim Lee, like you said, Ivy League educated. Certainly, you know, I'm not saying that he was just super, you know, super duper white collar, but more of an executive mindset. When you listen to what Todd McFarlane said, he sounds more like a union man. He's coming from the working class side of things, and it was interesting that they were able to mesh that for even as long as they did.
Yeah, it really is kind of an unlikely crew. It's like they really were rock stars in their way. And I'd love to see the Behind the Music documentary on these guys, because a lot of different egos and outlooks clashing in that room.
Yeah, the closest thing you can get is reading that book, Image Comics Road to Independence. And for whatever reason, the print version is just out of hand now. People want like $400 for it. I ordered like 2 months ago for $40. All of a sudden, it shot up to $400. I guess that's that 90s teaching me how to, you know, get in on that market.
Yeah, they should publish it with 12 different covers.
right. We were talking about the Image guys being rock stars. I know there's no equivalent for that in the 70s exactly, because there's no equivalent for that in the history of comic books, period. But what were some of the rock star guys that maybe, even though you didn't get all the books, when you know, the books you did get, you talked to your friends about at school, you know, who did everybody focus on then? Like, what were the big names? And especially if there's like a surprising one or two, because there's always some guy like when we were hanging out, you know, Jim Lee was great, Rob Liefeld was great, et cetera, et cetera. But people love Jim Valentino a lot more than you would think.
Yeah, it was just a different era. The 70s, and I'm more of an expert in Marvel in the 70s than I am in DC in the 70s, for instance. So when I'm talking about the 70s, I'm going to be sliding DC, and that's why. I'm just not as familiar with their output in that time. But Marvel at the time, they struck me as being a little more like a frat house than a comic book company or a business in a lot of ways. Now, the notion of a Marvel bullpen where all the creators were sitting cheek by jowl and creating together on a day-by-day basis, it never happened, not even in the golden or the silver age of comics. It was an invention of Stan Lee to try to create this sense of what Marvel Comics was.
And a brilliant one at that.
Guys that were on staff, you know, they had people that came in a couple of days a week, had meetings back and forth. But the idea of it being this sort of 9-to-5 or, you know, 9-to-midnight experience where all these guys were working together, that was a construction. But there was a culture around Marvel Comics in the 70s of creators, often younger people that grew up as fans of comics in the Silver Age in the 60s, and then moved to New York to take editorial jobs with Marvel. And they all kind of came up together. So guys like Roy Thomas and Jerry Conway and you know, Marv Wolfman and these Marvel stalwarts for that decade were all people that, if they weren't actually working in the office together all the time, they knew each other, they hung out, they went to parties together, they were professional rivals with each other. And as a consequence, this sort of house style emerged among Marvel people that almost accidentally propelled that Marvel universe forward for this period of a decade. Now, what that meant was, to me, at least in my experience, Marvel books in the 70s, there were a few that are pretty good, some that I think might even be brilliant, but the worst of the Marvel books in the 70s, which really weren't that terrible, but the floor was pretty high. So if you picked up a Marvel book in the 70s, you could usually be guaranteed that it's a, you know, a C+, B- book, it might occasionally be an A. Now, it might be really late. It might be a filler. It might be a sudden change of creator that, you know, throws you off and you're disappointed. But the quality, the floor was pretty high. That being said, the ceiling was also pretty low. So in any given month, you know, you knew what you were going to get. There weren't real huge flights of fancies in most of those books. I think the exceptions were, at the time, as I hinted at this earlier, they were the books that weren't getting a lot of editorial attention. The top sellers at Marvel in the 70s, their most predictable books, were the Spider-Man books and Fantastic Four and Conan, which I happen to love. But those are the books that were kind of locked into a certain set of expectations. It was the books that were off the radar, people weren't really paying attention to. Books like Captain Marvel or Deathlock or Black Panther, as I mentioned, or any of Steve Gerber's books, for crying out loud. You know, the three Howard the Duck stuff, which really put him on the map when he was doing Defenders or Omega, these crazy books that he started off doing, those early Guardians of the Galaxy. Those books were crazy. And on any given month, you might find something really unique. So it's unique that you wouldn't even expect to read today in terms of what the creator's voice was able to offer. So for me, the superstars, the rock stars, in a long-winded way of answering your question, but the rock stars at Marvel, the 70s were mostly writers, with the exception of Jim Starlin, who was a writer and an author and an artist, of course, but mostly were the writers. Thomas was great, still was writing stuff, you know, doing a lot of books in addition to being editor briefly, but also characters like Don McGregor and Rich Buckler, who was both a writer and an artist on Deathlock. It's a very interesting book.
Jim Starlin is probably, of all the things when it comes to talking about the Bronze Age and the 90s, and in particular the 70s of the 90s, he is like the bridge, because what's the 70s all about? Like, I've read all the great Warlock stuff, the Captain Marvel stuff, the Warlock Thanos Avengers, you know, confrontations, and they're amazing, they're soul-searching, they make you rethink, you know, life, death, tomorrow, yesterday. And what did I get right when I was getting into comic books in the 90s, I got Jim Starlin, Thanos, Warlock, mixed up with the Avengers, making you rethink life, death, yesterday, tomorrow. I don't think that they're, you know, the same. And there's every now and then someone's like, ah, he just writes that one story. They're not the same. I think these characters grow and change. You know, they stay rivals and they stay enemies because, you know, that happens even as people grow and change. You know, I didn't care for corporations 10 years ago. I still don't, but I'm not the same person I was 10 years ago. We're still pretty, you know, pretty much enemies. I just think it's amazing that Jim Starlin is that bridge, and that story, it just, it's so timeless, even with its little variants. I think that's one thing that we could definitely agree on. If you put Jim Starlin on Thanos in the 70s or the 90s, it's going to be pretty amazing for the most part.
Oh, Starlin's an interesting creator because almost unique among the creators at Marvel or in comics at that time, is he's a guy that came into the company with this kind of crazy story he wanted to tell. And he'd sort of pick up and move to whatever book was offered to him and continue to tell the same story. So it's like, I'm going to torture the analogy here, but there are movie stars, right? And there are some movie stars that are stars because of their personality and some because of their ability to disappear into a role. So Robert De Niro, great movie star, but you might have a hard time recognizing him from film to film sometimes because he so disappears into his role. He's a different guy. And he has his distinctive mannerisms, but you know, his Travis Bickle character from Taxi Driver is very different than Jimmy the Jet from Goodfellas. It's both De Niro, but they're different characters. But then an actor like John Wayne, for instance, or maybe Groucho Marx, these are guys you show up to the movies because you want to see John Wayne. You don't know what character he's playing. It's John Wayne. Likewise with Groucho Marx, it's always Groucho, even though it's Rufus T. Firefly in one movie and, you know, somebody else in another. So there's two different ways to be a movie star: be a great actor or be a great personality. And some people, well, in comics, I would say that Starlin is one of those guys that's a great personality because his personality comes through in every book that he does. Whether he was doing a fill-in issue or, you know, he was thrown an assignment to work with Gary Friedrich on Iron Man and introduced Thanos just because he could squeeze him in, or then later showed up in Captain Marvel and decided there's a great place for Thanos to show up, or then had a dispute and basically fired himself off of Captain Marvel and showed up a few months later on Warlock. And, oh, by the way, I'll do a Thanos story here. And then having Warlock canceled out from under him. So, well, what do I have now? Well, I could do the Marvel 2-in-1 annual and an Avengers annual. Oh, I know, Thanos! The same story again and again. But, boy, it was fun. You know, we loved it. Even when it was literally the same story. It's like, well, Thanos has shown up, and he has a big battle fleet, he's going to destroy the Earth. He must have told that story 3 or 4 times at Marvel alone in the 70s. So, yeah, I can see what people say he's playing the same note. But, you know, if he is, it's a pretty good note.
Yeah, I'm a big steak fan. I mean, you know, I could have steak 4 times a week. What would be the big deal?
I'm sorry?
I'm a big steak fan. I could have steak 4 times a week. What's the big deal?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm okay with that, too. Yeah, and I never really got tired of Jim Starlin's crazy cosmic stories. And, you know, like, and I followed him into Dreadstar and some of the other books that he wrote as well. I think, if anything, I would like to see him do more different types of titles at Marvel. I would love to see what he could do with one of their monster books or put him on Ghost Rider or something. But I gather he was kind of a... You know, he's a free spirit and maybe a little prickly and not the easiest guy to work with. And it seemed like he was being fired from Marvel and rehired like every other month. And so he never had a really long run of any given book there. It seemed like he'd last maybe a dozen issues at most and then he was moving on.
Well, he's a very nice guy. I was fortunate enough to get to interview him last year and he gave us 2 hours of his time. It was super nice. So, you know, awesome. I'm sure that whatever difficulties he may have had in the 70s getting along with Marvel probably had more to do with, you know, probably being mistreated by a corporate structure or disagreements about pay than it was just like him being a jackass.
Oh, yeah, I don't doubt that that's the case. And certainly, you know, chafing under Marvel's editorial direction was not something that Mr. Starlin had a monopoly on at all. I think every creator in that time, you know, famously, Steve Gerber, of course, is involved in lawsuits with Marvel. But everybody at that time, Roy Thomas, Steve Englehart, all these guys were, you know, brilliant creators from Marvel, but ended up leaving the company, working for the competition. They all had their disagreements with Marvel, I know.
One of the things that, you know, I wanted to talk to you about in regards to the 1990s comics also was just, you were a writer during the 1990s, but you also have told me, you know, you didn't get to experience a lot of the 1990s, you know, like, you know, you haven't read like the great Captain America run or a couple of other, you know, great titles, maybe Kingdom Come or Marvels. So you have this kind of perspective that's kind of like somebody who's familiar with the material, but also still kind of a semi-outsider's perspective. And I wanted to know just, you know, from that outsider's perspective, what are the 3 or 4 major things from a creative standpoint that just turn you off about the 1990s? And again, I'm not going to say they weren't there. Like I said in an article I wrote for the Superblog team up, Outsiders number 11 might be the worst comic book I've ever read, ever, from any era.
I remember that, yes. I remember your review and recap of that book. Fortunately, I didn't read it. So you're right. I should fully confess, when I'm talking about 90s comics, to a large extent, I'm arguing from a position of ignorance. Not that that's ever stopped anybody from arguing about comic books.
Hey, we met on the internet. How else do you do it?
Well, you know, my own personal story is I read comics. I first started reading comics in the mid-70s when I was 12 years old. Off and on through comics in the 70s because you're a kid, you don't have a lot of money. And I left home actually very early and was working full-time to make a living, and money was tight. So I missed a lot of books in the early part of the 1980s as well. But by the time like the mid-80s rolled around, I was able to get back into comics, and I had enough of an income, and I was ordering them by mail and finding ways to, you know, sustain my habit. But you're right, I did drop out in the early 90s, and it happened for a couple reasons. One was that I was a working creator. Well, not that sounds a little bigger than it was. I was writing comics for Malibu in the 1990s, and at one point, I literally found I was reading one of my books, and I realized that I had unintentionally copied something that I saw in another creator's book in the 1990s. I can't remember what it was. Just some set piece or monster or some silly thing. But at the time, I had this reaction to it. I was like, geez, that was unintentional. I don't want to be plagiarist. And I said, you know what? I'm not going to read any more comics. I'm just going to create them. Now, that was a stupid choice. But that was the choice I made. You have to continue to be conversant with what's going on in your field. Otherwise, you just, you know, you're going up on the backside. But I wouldn't have been able to make that choice if I hadn't had sort of a creep sweeping distaste with what was happening in comics at the time. And it really was a reaction to, I got out right about the time that Image was getting started. It really was a reaction to this kind of, you know, sort of gimmick-driven, very sort of loud and extreme kind of comic book storytelling that just didn't go down very easily with me as a kid raised in the 70s. So maybe it was just it was like an old man that didn't like listening to that newfangled music. You could certainly level that charge against me. But there was, I just felt that comics were no longer telling stories that were relevant to me. And I also felt that the characters that I loved, the properties that I loved, were not being served especially well by creators at that time. And that caused me some bitterness, and it caused me to turn away from it. And also, there's also that sense of being a craftsman, of being a professional. It's like, geez, if only I could get a chance to write these characters, I could do a better job than these guys. But I wasn't in a position to do that. So it was all kind of balled up and paused and ejected me from comics for about 20 years. So from, I'd say, about 1993 to, you know, when I started my blog in 2012 or whatever it was, I wasn't paying much attention to the comic book business at all. So you're right, I do have a weird outsider perspective. It's almost like I was struck on the head or something. and then I'm kind of foggy.
You woke up and there's Youngblood.
Yeah, well, I've read some of the books from that era, because I've read the collection and stuff. I read Marvel's Kingdom Come and stuff various times, and there's some stuff in there that I like, but I wasn't around on a day-to-day basis. I wasn't a guy that was going into a comic shop every day. I wasn't a guy that felt any kind of, you know, sense of competitiveness in terms of I got to buy all these comics and collect them. I wasn't following the great artists or the creators of the day eagerly from one book to the next. Totally no interest in that. What I have interest in, even now as a comic book reader, is like long runs of a single creative team. So the books that I most likely get excited about from the 70s are Marv Wolfman and Gene Colan on Tomb of Dracula, or Doug Mensch writing Master of Kung Fu with three or four excellent pencilers over the course of a decade. And those are not, I can sit down and I can grab 50 of those books and I can read them and they'll be long, continuous storyline. Same thing with Chris Claremont and John Byrne on X-Men when I first got started. And these are runs of comics that aren't interrupted by mandatory editorial crossovers or by renumbering stunts or by sudden changes in creative teams. And that, to me, is the most rewarding aspect of comic books, is that sort of long read and watching creators evolve over time and characters evolve over time. And the 90s doesn't give you too many opportunities for that kind of experience. So to take a step back, my impressions of the 90s are, I see a lot of scowling heroes with dimpled cheeks and 5 o'clock shadow, with big shoulder pads, lots of knee pads and patches and belts and guns, a lot of grimaces, a lot of bullets going off, a lot of creators aping, frankly, Alan Moore and Frank Miller, who exploited those tropes and did a lot better in the 80s. I see everything being very kind of grim and gritty and violent and extreme, but at the same time, I see it being very impermanent, and especially in the way Marvel and DC properties are handled at that time, I see there's a motto that says it takes 20 years to grow a tree and 20 minutes to burn it down. And I felt in a lot of cases that these characters were so mishandled, not just by the creators, but also by the editorial staff that was enabling those creators, that I just didn't recognize the characters as they were being depicted in that particular era.
Those are fair points. There's not a lot of super long runs in the 1990s. I mean, I can offer you up Mark Waid on The Flash. He was there for, you know, quite some time and really made The Flash into something very special. I would also offer you up the Superman and Batman books, even though they had different creative teams due to the fact that, you know, you had Mike Carlin and Denny O'Neil as kind of the group editor. There's a feel to every one of them. And the guys who were on them, including the aforementioned Doug Mensch, Chuck Dixon, Larry Hama does some Batman then, Louise Simonson writes some great Superman stuff, Dan Jurgens, Jerry Ordway, great art by John Bogdanov, I cannot pronounce that gentleman's name. I apologize, sir. We are Facebook friends. I should do you better. But you know, and great art, you know, Kelly Jones and other folks on the Batman books. Jim Aparo is still doing Batman then as well. So he's like, it's funny because he's like my favorite Batman guy. And of course, he cuts his Batman chops in the 70s. And I think those are what I would offer you. But pickings are sparse. There's no lie about that. Things are really, really disjointed in the 90s. Howard Mackey is on Ghost Rider for a long, long time. And again, like Kurt Busiek and George Perez on Avengers. That's another one I can pop up. But the Spider-Man titles, like you know, they're nuts. They don't make any sense. There seems to be a point where corporate was dictated. I don't think this is the fault of the creators or even the group editor in the early 90s would have been Danny Fingeroth. I think that they were really, really, really interfering with Spider-Man constantly from the corporate side. Not even like, you know, telling them what to do, but just, you know, everything they did, they had a comment about it. And that's how the Spider-Man books feel at the time. But that's a fair charge against the 90s. I can't deny that. There aren't enough ongoing, long creative teams, but one of them that's still going to this day is one of the Image guys, Eric Larson. Now, he's written and drawn Savage Dragon for 20 years now.
Yeah, very steady hand there, Mr. Larson. You're right. And those names you all mentioned, they're all great creators. I wouldn't take issue with any of them. Mark Waid especially, tremendous writer. And I think the thing about Mark's work is that he, now I'm going to reincorporate, is I think Mark kind of looks back to these eras of comics of 70s and the 80s that I most value, and I think he brought a lot of those values forward into his work in the 1990s. And Mark's about the same age as I am. I think he's almost exactly the same age as I am, so it's not surprising that we'd have similar tastes in that regard. And I like Kurt Busiek's work, too, especially like Astro City, which was a book of the you know, 80s, 90s, right?
That's the 90s, and he's still doing that book.
Yeah, and it's you know, continuing, and being published in Image now is doing it, I think. But the thing about Astro City is it's also a book that's a very nostalgic book, at least, you know, the early, when it got started, looking back at these older tropes. You know, the best Superman story I think I ever read was in Astro City. It was a Samaritan story that he did, maybe in the very first issue.
I believe so.
I forget what the title was, something about the Man of Tomorrow maybe, but it was this idea of, okay, you have this supremely powerful Superman character, what's a day in his life really like? It was called In Dreams, that was the name of the story, In Dreams, one issue story, I believe it was Astro City number one. It's just brilliant, but that was a book that, you know, I don't think Kurt would say, well, he just conceived of this character in a vacuum. No, he was writing the Superman story that at the time he couldn't sell at DC, really, you know, but it ended up being a brilliant Superman story. So they're reinventions rather than inventions. But okay, now I'm gonna go to bat again for comics in the 70s. I'll challenge you. you tell me here, Dean, if you think that this is an unsupportable statement. I'm gonna make the claim that there hasn't been a significant new comic book character created inside the comic book establishment at Marvel or DC since the 1970s. I'm going to say that since Wolverine's debut in 1974, 1975, and really his kind of apotheosis to the character we know now when X-Men launched in whatever that was, 76, that Marvel hasn't created a substantially important new character since that time. Also the 80s, also the 90s, a lot of reinvention, a lot of reappropriation of things, a lot of spinning and twisting and mashing things together, changing characters' names, costumes, etc. But where are the great new characters from these creators, and even in the 80s, but certainly in the 90s and after? I'm less familiar with what's going on at DC, but I'd be willing to bet that the situation is very similar over there. Where are the great new characters?
Well,
the 60s and the 70s.
I think, you know, a lot of the reason for that, you know, especially since the Image guys went you know, went their own way is people realized that, you know, when you create a character working for Marvel, Marvel owns that character. I mean, they always knew. It's not like they, I'm not calling these people idiots. They're like, you know, I had no idea what work for hire was or whatever. But it just became more in vogue to keep anything new and original for yourself. I have to vehemently disagree with you in regards to Wolverine being the last character of note or importance created by Marvel. Although I don't think many have been created since this guy. I think it's almost inarguable that Deadpool is an incredibly important character. I'm not a huge Deadpool fan, but this is a guy who's going to get his own movie like next year. He's one of the few characters in the last 15 years that could carry multiple titles. If you go to conventions, there are thousands of Deadpools. I think Deadpool has captured the public and even outside of the comic book buying public in a way that, that I think that qualifies as what you're looking for.
Yeah, I think Deadpool's a good pick. And if I was gonna name any one Marvel character after Wolverine, it probably would be Deadpool. The reason I think Deadpool's still on the bubble is I don't think that character has a lot of relevance or traction outside of comic book fandom. A movie may change that, but the idea, I don't think a character yet, you know, stands for something the way Wolverine does. In other words, if I'm going to describe to you who Wolverine is, I can do it in a few deft strokes, that he's this mutant with a healing power, and he's been scandalously misused by the government, and his mind's been wiped, and he's been turned into a killing machine, but he's really a gentle soul inside. He's a warrior poet. You can kind of get a sense of who that character is. And that's a character that can work in a number of mediums. It doesn't necessarily have to be a comic book character. Deadpool being so inherently tied to comics, mocking comics, being very meta about comics, I don't think it has the breadth that a character like Wolverine does, or many of the characters that preceded him at Marvel in the 60s or the 70s. But, okay, so if I give you Deadpool, if we just can see that Deadpool is potentially a great Marvel creation, who else? You know, who else has come along in the last 25, 30 years? And actually, I don't mean this as an indictment necessarily of the 90s. I think it's just, it's interesting because as we see these characters, both Marvel and DC characters, becoming gigantic successes in film and television, and commanding millions, billions of dollars around the world, millions of eyeballs, people that are greatly involved in these characters, and then you juxtapose this against the comic book business that still, in a given month, is doing backflips if they can sell a million copies of an individual comic. There's a gulf there between the concept of superheroes as a mass audience wants to see them and the way superheroes are depicted in comic books. And one of the arguments that fans seem to throw up is that, well, yeah, they aren't selling that many copies of Avengers or X-Men now as they did, you know, compared to decades past. But it's important that they keep those lines going because it's a rich source of intellectual property for the movie business. But the intellectual property the movie business is rating all comes from the 60s and the 70s. They haven't created anything new in the last 30 years that stands up, for audiences today when they get transformed into these movie stars. So it's a little off point, but I guess to go all the way around the block and reconnect it is that the 70s, I think, were a more vibrant area in terms of, or era in terms of creating characters and stories and worlds that still resonate with us today, whereas to a large extent, the books done at the big two in the 90s feels a little bit more to me like it was riding on water. There's just sort of an impermanence to it.
There definitely is a lot of reinvention in the 90s. I mean, one character that's probably going to take off in the mainstream is a reinvention or you know, slight tweak is War Machine. War Machine, I think, is going to be, you know, and already is a pretty decently big, much bigger deal than you ever would have thought in the 90s, but I think he's going to take off. I also feel like Deadpool will work in regards to that, because while he does a lot of meta commentary on comic books and the like, I think that you can just tweak that at the movies to where, I mean, one of his big things is breaking the fourth wall. Well, he doesn't have to break the fourth wall and tell you, you know, about comic book stuff. He could make jokes about the other movies that are going up against Deadpool at the time, because certainly there will be others. I'm sure this is going to be a big action movie for, you know, the early summer, you know, so it's going to have some competition. I think that's something that they could do. And I also think that outside of the big two, it's impossible to state just how big Spawn got in such a quick amount of time. To the point where, like my girlfriend, who, you know, has been writing for the Unspoken Decade but isn't a huge comic book fan, she knew who Spawn was, and to her, Spawn is 90s comics. I mean, think about that, you know, Spawn's created 1992. That's when number one comes out. He has a movie by 98, and he's been on HBO for, like, 2 years since then.
Yeah, there's only a very successful character from that era. And a character that I think is probably due for a reboot, you know, re-examination in film. Again, he's a character that kind of feels like an accumulation of other characters, rather than a character that's a, you know, an original creation to himself. But it was true that the story, the character was depicted, drawn, presented with such fury and such spirit that it would be impossible to ignore Spawn.
And
again, I was qualifying. I was trying to put you in the corner by talking about the big two.
Hey, you try and put the screws to me, I'm going to screw right out from under you, just like Johnny Cash.
Yeah, well, very wisely, you know, very wisely, Mr. McFarlane hung onto that character for himself. He didn't publish that over at Marvel.
Right.
He'd be a very... It'd be a different story.
And I think that in the 1980s, and we haven't gotten to this yet, but it appears the Suicide Squad's going to be a huge deal. And while the characters themselves in the Suicide Squad, for the most part, weren't created in the 1980s other than Amanda Waller, this thing's starting to take off. There's an amazing groundswell of support for it already. And I think that, you know, it's going to be a big boom when the movie comes out. And but I'll let the 1980s people defend themselves some other time. But I would give you Suicide Squad from the 1980s from the big two, but I don't disagree with you that I think that there is a dearth of original characters that aren't just reimagined or tweakings in that time, and I think there are lots of other lovable characters too, though, that came out, like I love Slapstick from the 90s, who's basically a human cartoon, and he just didn't take off. It's not like there weren't some original ideas of the big two, but they didn't catch fire, and I wonder if, you know, part of that was that, you know, we didn't want them, you know, the audience, but also part of it is that so many resources at the big two, and this was true in the 70s as well, are going to go to promote established franchises.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's, again, the way the market's set up is that the audiences generally want the same, only different. They'll tell you that they're looking for bold new directions, but then they'll show up and buy the same book month in, month out. And that's a behavior that's not unique to comic fans at all. That's in almost every field of endeavor. How many movie fans do you know that complain about we get same Transformers movies all the time? I'm sick and tired of them, but they continue to make ungodly amounts of box office.
Right.
You know, there's a difference between what people say they want and what they actually want. And I think that the comic book companies in the 90s were very savvy about that and continue to give us exactly what we wanted, which was what they'd always had. But at the same time, I think that it's, you know, the editorial staff, certainly the ownership, publishing staff at these companies needs to have a sense of custodianship both for the characters that they already have and for the new readers they need to recruit and for where these characters are going to go long term so that they remain viable. They don't get destroyed by, you know, short-term gimmicks or crazy reinventions or whatever. This is an area, actually, where I think Marvel's has gotten pretty dialed in recently. I'm not a consistent reader of contemporary comics. I'll read a digital issue here or there. I'll read a collection. But Marvel seems to have a pretty firm hand at the tiller in terms of the way they want to develop their characters, at least over a period of 2 or 3 years, maybe not decades, but they don't feel like they're going month to month necessarily. I can take issue maybe with some of the decisions they've made or the choices they're making in terms of their editorial influence or where they choose to put their attention, but there's no doubting that there are architects behind that line that are guiding the books with a sense of story and character. They're trying to get to a destination. That's one of the things that's rewarding, I think, about contemporary comics compared to the 70s, which is very ad hoc. For all the talk of a Marvel Universe, it was just chaos. Everybody was picking it up as they went along. There was very little cohesiveness. And what cohesiveness was there was sort of accidental. The same author or creator was on multiple books. So, you know, Steve Englehart is writing both Defenders and Avengers at the time, so, you know, we'll do the Avengers Defenders War. So there were those kind of synergies, but in terms of multiple creators getting together and all sort of rowing in the same direction, Marvel's really got that dialed in. I admire them for it.
I'm gonna, you know, hit the tennis ball back onto your side of the court, if you will, since, you know, you said, okay, you said nobody, you know, has created anything, you know, in the 80s or the 90s. Well, the other way, and again, I don't, I sound like a jerk, but I don't necessarily disagree with your overall sentiment. I mean, I love Cable and think he's important, but he's only important within the confines of comic books that he did not bust out significantly. He did with people my age because of the X-Men cartoon, but, you know, I mean, but what, but people 10 years younger than me, they probably don't know who he is. I don't know. I have to talk to somebody 10 years younger than me. But you talked a lot about the scowling and the grimacing heroes of the 1990s.
Yes.
And I don't disagree with you. You know, I'm a Punisher guy, and Punisher was big in the 90s. But where did he come from? Well, he came from the 70s. You talk about the grim and gritty Ghost Rider and his scowl. Where did Ghost Rider show up first? Oh yeah, that was the 70s. And how about Deathlok? And, like, he was pretty big in the night. Where did he come? Yeah, that was the 70s. And I want, and when I read about stuff in the 70s, I hear that there was a lot of contemporary complaints about the new direction on Batman, like when Steve Englehart turned the Joker back into a murderer. And I've heard, and there were lots of complaints about these edgy comics. Like you mentioned earlier, you know, Steve Gerber, I mean, basically had sex depicted in Guardians of the Galaxy. There are a lot of very, you know, iffy and edgy comic books, especially in the black and white lines where you could get away with a ton. Not that the 90s, it was all open, okay? But there's something, you know, I always say there's something dangerous and exciting about the black and white comics, but there's also something maybe a little seedy. And I wonder if that grimacing, scowling hero isn't just a grandchild or a child of your beloved 70s.
I'll give you that. I mean, certainly a character like Deathlok did feel like a character out of time. I have to say, when that issue of Astonishing Tales hit the racks, so let's say it was issue 25 or something, I was 12 years old or 13 years old when I got my hands on that comic. That felt like a hit of some kind of crazy drug. It was way, way, way outside my experience. The way the comic was created, the original comic had three different narratives. It had the omniscient narrator that was describing the story. It had Luther Manning, the soldier that was fighting with the computer talking back to him, and then it had an additional narrator that was this kind of bloodthirsty sort of, you know, gruesome violence addict that was describing things all the time. So it was just this explosion of word balloons and caption boxes, this very layered and challenging story about a villain, frankly. I mean, Deathlok was a monstrous character. Crazy things happened in that book, you know. Some very progressive. There was an interracial marriage in that book, which was unusual for us at the time. But also, Deathlok tries to commit suicide at one point, which is, I mean, the thing with the comics code is they weren't paying attention to what was going on at Deathlok. So, yeah, I'll give you that. I mean, that's a character. I know that character's been, you know, brought back dozens of times and fit right in the 90s with all these other guys. But I think, I guess it felt like when Deathlok came out in the 70s, it was really reacting to something. It was very different from what the other comics were like. Whereas in the 90s, it kind of feels like they're all angry young men. If you're all angry young men, you know, what are you mad at? Because you're getting to do whatever you want.
I think that one of the things that, you know, when it comes to those 70s comics, like we talked, you know, like I was mentioning, The Punisher rises in the 70s, Wolverine, Ghost Rider, and also Deathlok, and also those grimacing heroes of the early 90s, is the crime rate. The crime rate in the early 1990s was as high as it had been, I think, since like the late 60s. And the crime rate in the 70s, you know, was big. And also in both cases, the media blew it into, you know, they didn't blow it out of proportion because crime was an incredible problem in both eras. But they heightened that fear of crime to the point where we would see that reflected back at us in the pop culture.
Oh, yeah. If it bleeds, it leads. Story then, as now. And also those Marvel comics in the 70s were taking their lead from film. A lot of those guys were influenced by the great 70s action pictures, movies like The French Connection, for instance, which is a movie that scared the heck out of me when I was a kid because it showed such a threatening side of New York, such urban decay. I couldn't believe that this was the same country that I was living in, this idea that these corrupt cops and the mafia is running things and there's all this violence going on. It scared the heck out of me. And a lot of that trickled into the comic books. And in fact, that's one of the things that I like about the Bronze Age. It makes it interesting to me from the Silver Age comics, especially the DC Silver Age comics that were very kind of, you know, they felt like your father's comic.
The very white bread.
Out of touch. And then the 70s come around and so many comics are starting to touch things like drug abuse and corruption and urban blight and child abuse in light ways. You know, they didn't delve into them too deeply, but these were things that were problems in our society, and they were reflected, at least touched upon in comics, made them felt relevant, at least to a young person, you know, 13, 14 years old as I was at the time.
Yeah, and I think that my ultimate point when it comes to 90s comics is they just build upon what was there before. Just as the 70s built upon what was there before. You look at the Silver Age comics, a lot of the, the DC comics that you were mentioning, they're very obsessed with, like, space and science fiction stuff and getting to Mars, because that was what was on everybody's mind. While Marvel, you know, went in a slightly different direction, there's still space stuff, obviously. But there was more of a, you know, bringing it home and making it personal. And then in the 70s, you go to the next level. What's on people's minds? What are young people seeing? Well, you saw the French Connection, this is what's going to appeal to you, so Batman's going to get a little darker. There are drug problems in the country, so we're going to do Green Lantern and Green Arrow. And I just think the 90s are just the inevitable result of that. And when people
you can draw it down the line. It's a continuous, that's one of the things that makes it exciting. So in the 70s we get, you know, Death Wish or Dirty Harry, and then we get the Punisher, or you have, you know, this inexplicable outbreak of devil movies, quick pictures like The Exorcist, or crazy pictures like The Omen, and suddenly Marvel Comics overrun by Son of Satan.
right. Hey, Race the Devil is still one of the craziest movies I've ever seen. Race the Devil still scares me.
Yeah, they'll jump on those trends, to be sure, and that's reflecting what's going on in the popular consciousness. And if we go back and, you know, we should have a parallel podcast where we invite the movies of the 90s, so we talk about the sort of vapid action pictures that were really popular at the time that maybe hadn't held up as well, and then you can go through and you can find a few nuggets that are like, yeah, that's still a great picture, I really like Speed, or it's a great film, or whatever. So it's gonna be the same in either place, I think. And you're right, I think certainly it's indisputable that characters like Ghost Rider or Punisher have their roots in the 1970s. But the way those characters were depicted in the 90s was really very different. Even though the core DNA of those characters may have been around, you know, killing bad guys or punishing people as a spirit of vengeance, the way it was executed and maybe just the kind of casual violence that was common in the 90s was very different from the 70s, and I would argue in some ways maybe even a portrayal of those characters' roots. But as you know, the characters evolve over time, and as we said at the beginning of the podcast, comic books are an exploitative medium. So, of course, if that's what the audience wants, that's what you're going to give them, and I can't really even fault the creators for that, even though I have the luxury of sitting here in my easy chair and looking back at them 20 years later and tutting because, you know, they've interfered with my beloved childhood memories, but they lead to a fractured long-run experience. In the final summation, these guys are just trying to make their monthly number. That's what the audience wants. That's what the audience gets.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's one of the things I always tell people who criticize Rob Liefeld is just, like, it really doesn't matter what you think about what he drew. This is the early 90s. I don't care what you think. Like, this is what we wanted. This is what we got, and that's how it is. Although, when it comes to, you know, you say they were, you know, there was so much more violence, and they acted in a more violent fashion. I don't necessarily deny that, but isn't that the same thing that, you know, fans of the Silver Age that's the same accusation they'd levy against the 70s?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that's a fair statement. And you're right. I mean, Marvel had the advantage of reacting or reinventing rather than inventing. And the 90s creators did the same business. So let's roll it back. Let's think about, 1956 when Showcase did use the new Flash. And there's this explosion of creativity over at DC as they reintroduce these Golden Age characters and their Silver Age incarnations. We get the Flash, we get Green Lantern, we get Hawkman, and all these other characters that come back. But you're right, were cast, they still felt like your dad, but they were cast as, they were basically Kennedy men. They were Gemini astronauts. They were science heroes. They were New Frontier characters. And that's who they became, and that's who they stayed. They didn't evolve. So by the time Marvel decides, you know, basically Marvel's thrashing around and saying, well, the Justice League book is doing awful well. Why don't you go ahead and do our own version of Justice League? Stan Lee then, and then working with Jack Kirby, can say, well, all right, what are we going to do? First of all, we're going to do the same, only different. what does Marvel sell right now? They sell a lot of Marvel. They sell a lot of monster books and a lot of kind of weird story science fiction books. So the first issue, the cover of Fantastic Four number one, is going to have a giant monster on it. It could have been the same monster. Probably was the same monster that Jack Kirby had drawn every month for the last, you know, 5 years. And the characters are going to be kind of scientific. We're going to have these science heroes, but we're going to reinvent now. Instead of having secret identities, they'll have public identities. Instead of being perfect and loving their powers, they're going to feel cursed by their powers. Instead of being the get-along gang that always are working together to defeat the bad guy of the month, they're going to fight with each other. Instead of being strangers that come together, in many cases aliens that come together with no shared background, they're going to be family members with long, you know, with all these old issues that they're constantly dealing with. So Marvel had the opportunity to look at everything, look at the blueprint, the DNA that DC had laid out for superheroes and say, okay, we're going to take that, we're going to change it. Take that, we're going to change it. Take that, we're going to change it. And it led to the Marvel explosion, this beautiful, the Silver Age and the Bronze Age of Marvel Comics is still the greatest explosion of creativity, I think, that the comics business has really ever seen. So the DC, or the 90s, had the same opportunity. They could look at what Marvel and DC were doing. They could take it. They could reinvent. So they could go back and say, yeah, Watchmen, let's look at that, or Dark Knight, let's look at that. But I'm not convinced that they always took the best lessons away from those earlier forms, and I'm not sure that the reinvention that they offered was more relevant or more artistically valuable. And certainly, I don't believe it stood the test of time as well as those reinventions that came out of Marvel, and then later out of DC in the 80s when they reinvented their own catalog.
Yeah, it's hard to disagree with that when even Alan Moore himself is like, people took the wrong lesson from Watchmen to the point where he wrote something like Supreme in the 1990s, which you mentioned earlier, the best Superman story ever is the Samaritan story. Well, my favorite Superman stories are Alan Moore's Supreme. So I completely, you know, have to agree. And I also think that, you know, just based on Kirby alone, the 60s and the 70s are going to win as far as creative explosion, because we'll never see anything like him again. And I don't think it might be possible that there's never been a creative industry that's seen a creative force like Kirby, comic books or otherwise.
And the interesting thing, one of the things that interests me about Kirby, fascinating man, is that he was doing that reinvention in his 40s and his 50s. So the Image guys were these angry young men, these enfants terribles that were going to change everything about comics. But they were also young people and kind of callow, and it reflected in their work sometimes. It didn't have the depth. Jack Kirby, when he was working at Marvel in the 60s and into the 70s, he's in his 40s and his 50s. When he did Fourth World over at DC, he was in his 50s. And some of the stories reflect that. You know, the little cranky, you got men in hats, you got these, you know, white-haired heroes that don't quite, you know, don't really feel relevant. They feel like your dad in a lot of ways. But at the same time, he was creating stuff that just blew people away. So, and he went all the way back, because he did comics as a young person in the 40s with Captain America, and et cetera, right? So he knew where the bodies were buried. He understood comics as well, better than anybody in the business. And he kind of got an opportunity to reinvent himself. And he did a brilliant job of it and created these comic book characters we still love today. He was a very special cat to be able to do that at his age. Instead of when he by all rights should have been tired of it, to be so bursting and overflowing with new ideas and new ways to look at these old characters. You know, as the years go by, he just seems an even greater genius.
I couldn't agree more, and I appreciate you coming on here tonight. I think that in the end, we'll just have to agree to disagree a little bit, but in the end, we love comic books, and that's what's most important.
Absolutely. We're united in our love of comics, and you know, here we are all these decades later. You know, supposedly here I am 40 years past the era of comics that I most esteem, and I'm still a fan. I'm still running my silly comic book blog. I'm a guest on your podcast, which is great fun. I'm going to WonderCon this weekend, going to Comic-Con later. So even if I'm not, it's a broad feast. There's room at the table for everybody in comics, and our disagreements really can be fun, I think, more than divisive.
Yeah, absolutely. And the last thing I want to talk about before we go, and this is, you know, a pretty quick point or whatever, is I hear a lot of people, and I'm sure you've heard the same thing. They're like, 90s comics are crap. Most everything they put out in that decade was crap, and it wasn't very good. I am of the mindset that most comic books aren't super good, that most, in most comics in most decades are, I don't want to say crap because I don't want to insult the, you know, the creators who work hard, but most of them, they're just comic books. You read it and it's good or it's okay, but it's not life changing. You know, for every Watchmen, there are, you know, thousands and thousands of series that, you know, you kind of remember, but they're not changing the world or anything.
I have to agree, and I feel like I bought most of them and had a hell of a time trying to sell them recently before they downsized. And these are comics in the 70s and the 80s that aren't especially well esteemed. Yeah, I mean, they were disposable entertainment. I mean, like, one thing that the comics of the 90s indisputably did better in the 70s was production standards. I mean,
sure.
Print standards, better materials. In some cases, the artists were more technically adept. We can argue about whether they were better storytellers. So there's much of merit to have in that era as well. And you're right. I mean, it's only the rosy lens of nostalgia that lets me look at the 70s and even the 60s and say that all the comics are great. Far from it. And they were, you know, terribly inconsistent as well, and often late and sudden creative changes. And at Marvel especially, it seemed like any time a new writer took over a book, he was eager to throw out everything that the previous record done. So at that fight against that sort of long read narrative that I was setting up earlier, it really is only the exceptional books of the era that rise to that level of being worthy of study, and that's the case in any era, 90s or the 70s, doesn't matter.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I want to thank you for coming on here, Paul O'Connor. Longboxgraveyard.com. What can the folks look forward to? Because I bet I send you a couple hits. You know, I'm a big deal now. I'm the 90s guy. Nobody else does this.
I know, and that's why, you know, when the Unspoken Decade calls, I answer the phone. I'm happy to come on and talk to your listeners. Well, at longboxgraveyard.com, it's very, very kind of you to bring it up. But the blog bumps along. You know, I publish basically one big article a month, sometimes more. This right now at Longbox Graveyard, we're doing the Super Animal Showdown, March Madness Super Animal Showdown, where we're pitting super pets against each other, which is, you know, silly fun. It's looking like it's going to be Crypto and Lockjaw in the final. So readers can, or listeners can certainly come over to longboxgraveyard.com and vote in the ongoing tournament. And my feature for May is on Daredevil, number one, which is actually a Silver Age book rather than a Bronze Age book. And I'm very excited about Daredevil coming on Netflix this month, so I want to do some Daredevil content. Daredevil, number one, by Stan Lee and Bill Everett, I think is one of the best single-issue stories that Marvel ever published, one of the best origin stories of all time. It's right there alongside Amazing Fantasy, number 15, is being a great introductory single-issue story for a superhero. So I'm looking at that. And then as the summer wears on, we'll be doing articles on the Avengers. I have some stuff. I'll be looking at some other media later in the summer. I'll be looking at some superhero video games. And then towards the end of the year, October, November, I haven't decided yet. I think I'm going to do my tell-all article about Ultra Cards, which was a comic book collectible card game that I was contracted to make for first Malibu Comics and then later for Marvel. During that period of time when Bill Jennings was running Fleer, before he moved over to Marvel Comics, and was right in the middle of that collectible card frenzy that you discussed earlier in the podcast, it's a bizarre, strange tale about a comic book game that I made that was never published, that I made good coin for, because basically they bought my silence and take it off the market. Really, really weird tale. So I'll probably get into that towards the end of the year. And then, you know, as long as I continue to get my couple hundred hits a day, Longbox Graveyard will continue for several years more, I expect.
Well, that's awesome, and of course, I expect to drop in every now and then. Hopefully going to do a little more Punisher for you later.
Yeah, you promised me Punisher, and you know, recently you did a Rampaging Hulk article for me, which I greatly appreciated and admired. And what I love that you fill gaps for me, and especially because there are things that I remember. Yeah, I remember Punisher, I don't really read it. You know, and I remember I had a few issues of Rampaging Hulk, but aside from Savage of Conan, I didn't really touch this Marvel Black and White. So it's great when you can come and bring those stories to the readers. I know they appreciate it.
Well, yeah, and it's always a pleasure to be over there. Paul O'Connor, longboxgraveyard.com. Just thanks again for your time, and we will talk to you next time right here, folks. The Legions of the Unspoken. Until next time, I hope all your foil covers are there, and I hope that you get all of those variant trading cards you're looking for. Thanks again, Paul.
Absolutely, Dean. Thanks anytime.